This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us on Trumpet Hour today. We're ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel of trumpet writers. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Shalom.
As of this week, the U.S. government recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. It's going to start preparations for establishing the American embassy there. This decision by President Donald Trump was loudly condemned throughout the world. People said it was going to hurt prospects for Israeli-Palestinian peace. What will be the actual effects of this decision, and how might it accelerate the fulfillment of the Bible's many end-time prophecies about Jerusalem? For this, we're going to turn to our man who's positioned right there in the holy city, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so this decision is something that Mr. Trump obviously campaigned on and something that he is now following through with. It is going to take a number of years to actually bring about the embassy move. Mr. Tillerson said today that it was going to probably take about 2 years. But the ball is rolling now to move the embassy to Jerusalem. It'll be located in West Jerusalem.
Which is territory that's not even under the Palestinians have never claimed West Jerusalem specifically. This is Israeli territory. Shouldn't be anything
right.
Particularly
there
controversial.
There shouldn't be any type of disagreement here. And that's what's interesting about Mr. Trump's comments. They were extremely weighted, and he was careful not to say anything. He didn't call Jerusalem the eternal capital of the Jews. He didn't say that he was going to put it in East Jerusalem. He didn't say where in Jerusalem he was going to put it. But everybody knows he's going to put it in West Jerusalem. The current consulate right now is kind of in East Jerusalem, of where it would be, or right on the border. But that's not going to be the location. So he's going to build an entirely new building in West Jerusalem. And this was a no-brainer, really, just because we, in the eventual, if there is going to be peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, obviously West Jerusalem's going to be coming to the Jews. This was never on the negotiating table, West Jerusalem. And yet, we saw the whole world, it seemed, come down hard on Mr. Trump, saying that this was going to jeopardize, or it blew up the peace negotiations between Palestinians and Israelis. The chances for peace are now snuffed out. This is going to enrage the entire Muslim world. This is what many have been saying, both Muslim leaders, European leaders. And no one really has given Mr. Trump too much support in this, apart from Israelis. Obviously, Israelis, people in this city, it's just a statement of absolute fact that Israel is the capital, or that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Everybody in Israel knows that. We live like that here. Even the Arabs that live in the city would acknowledge that fact as well. So really, the reason that this hasn't happened for 20 plus years, even though it was voted by the Senate and the House of Representatives to happen back in 1995, was that every previous United States government has tried to negotiate peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And they felt that the presidents did. They felt that this move will jeopardize peace. Trump feels like this move is necessary for peace to at least just get the acknowledge the fact that Israel is in Jerusalem and they're in Jerusalem to stay.
Well, I've even heard some commentators say that, President Trump just gave away a major bargaining chip that he had to try to put pressure on Israel in any potential peace negotiations, as if the stumbling block has been Israeli intransigence.
That's right. Left wing, right wing, it doesn't matter. Everyone in Israel knows that this is going to be the capital. Well, it knows that West Jerusalem is going to stay inside Israel's control. And maybe Mr. Trump was just trying to clear the air, make this announcement at the very beginning so that he doesn't have this won't be a stumbling block in the future to the Palestinians. Maybe he's thinking that. But regardless, I guess the surprising response to me was the response of the rest of the world, that here we have Jerusalem, a city for the past 70 years that has been the capital of Israel, has acted that way, and has really, I mean, no city in the history of mankind has had the attachment to a certain people like Jerusalem has had to the Jews. So this should be an absolute no-brainer. And yet the world is so focused right now on Jerusalem and not in the favor of the Jews or the Israelis.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about some of the international response and particularly the European response and get Richard in on the discussion. But before we do that, if you could just describe, with all of the Chicken Little sky is falling warnings of just how disastrous this was going to be once this decision was made, you're there in Jerusalem. It seems like it's been fairly muted in terms of, you know, the street anger and that type of thing, which you would expect, especially to pick up on Friday, right?
Right. So today, the first indication I had that it wasn't going to be a big deal was the fact that the Israeli police did not limit an age for those that could enter the Temple Mount. Normally, Friday morning prayers, if they suspect something's going to be disastrous, they will limit the age and say, you've got to be over 60 if you're going to come into the Temple Mount. They didn't even do that. And so we kind of knew that it wasn't going to get too heated. Like, there have been plenty of protests. Most of them have been confined to the West Bank, Bethlehem, a number of different places in the West Bank, Ramallah, but nothing really here in Jerusalem much at all. Nothing like we saw back in June with the Temple Mount impasse, June and July. That right. was much more violent in Jerusalem. And so I feel like the Israelis and even the Israeli Arabs and even the Arabs in Jerusalem, this was kind of an announcement that was just a no-brainer for them.
Yeah, it seems like a certain amount of vindication for the Trump administration right off of the bat. But looking at how European capitals have reacted, you mentioned just how that's what most surprised you, is the way that the international community responded. Maybe you can just give us a sense of what that is. And Richard, if you want to jump in, feel free to do that.
Yeah, well, I think no doubt you had a lot of comments from the Arab world that were against this, but nothing too harsh from the Egyptians, nothing too harsh from the Saudis. They're on good terms with the Trump administration. They've got to please their population by saying and condemning it, but nothing too harsh at all. But you have had different riots take place across the world. I was looking at some earlier from Thailand, I believe. They were rioting. Somalia. There were riots in Jordan just because they've got a large Palestinian population. Riots in the Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon. So obviously you've got that, but then the European response was pretty direct and basically saying, we don't agree with Mr. Trump. This is jeopardizing the future peace negotiations. We're not moving our embassy. Even the likes of the United Kingdom did not jump on board. You would have expected them to say, well, this is, you know, at least be saying, well, I can see their reasoning for doing so, the United States, but it wasn't like that at all.
Yeah, I think that sums up the European Union's response. Well, I think there was a little more positivity from, say, those Eastern European countries, some of those countries that we kind of highlighted in the last Trumpet print edition, those strongmen countries. They're a little bit more kind of hard on Islam, and a few of them were, like the Czech Republic, were a bit more willing to support this move, or maybe I should say a little less negative. But yeah, that was the overall response from Europe. And I think the other kind of thing that comes out of the response from Europe is, in some ways, I think they see this as almost an opportunity for them to now get more involved with the peace negotiations, because the big message they're trying to put forward, and really a lot of people even in the United States are putting forward, is the U.S. president can no longer be relied on as an honest broker in the peace process. He's no longer a fair third party. He's blatantly taken the Israeli side. That's all nonsense, but that's the case that Europeans are making. And so they're saying, well, you want a powerful third party who's got a reputation for neutrality and fair dealings, come to us. We'll fill that. And so Federica Mogherini, who's kind of like the foreign minister of the bloc, she said that the European Union is going to get even more involved in the peace process after this. So she called it a difficult moment that requires a more determined commitment to peace.
What's interesting about her is just that this was a large goal from hers back in 2014 when she took up the office in November. She said, "What would make me happy is if a Palestinian state existed at the end of my term." So you can tell where what position she's coming from.
Right.
And then she said, "At that time, I think Jerusalem can be and should be the capital for two states." And then she also said that was back in 2014. And this week, she said that the European Union has a clear and united position. "We believe the only realistic solution to the conflict between Israel and Palestine is based on two states with Jerusalem as the capital of both." So she's coming out declaring that, yes, the Palestinians are going to have a capital in East Jerusalem as well, and kind of pledged towards that. And even going back to Richard's point about how this is kind of denying the United States as that position as being the broker for peace, that's what the Palestinians are saying right now as well. Saeb Erekat, the chief negotiator for the Palestinians, he came out and said that this step is prejudicing, dictating, closing doors for negotiation. And I think President Trump disqualified America from playing any role in the peace process. That's the chief negotiator for the Palestinians. So this decision by Trump looks like it's just laying out a red carpet for a European entrance into the peace process.
Yeah, I completely agree. And the other European leader who seems like they're making some moves as well to get involved is the Pope. On Tuesday, Pope Francis, he made a phone call to the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas to talk things through. And then he came out after Donald Trump made those statements and said, "I cannot keep quiet about my deep worry about the situation that has been created in the last few days." He called for respect of the status quo. He called for negotiations. He said he made a heartfelt appeal for these kind of negotiations. And so he was very heavily critical, very eager to get involved. And when you look at some of the things the Pope's been, or the papacy, the Catholic Church has been doing under Pope Francis, is it's made quite a dramatic increase in its role as a negotiator. Very high profile role in Colombia there with drawing an end to this 30-year-old conflict with the rebels over there. The Pope also then making visits to Jerusalem and making that famous visit at the wall there. So I think it also provides him with an opening to get more involved as well. And you could see it leading to some kind of big shift in the peace process over there.
Yeah, I believe President Erdogan in Turkey has already at least stated his intention to kind of go to the Pope as a negotiator now that he doesn't like the United States taking that position.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is interesting because Erdogan's kind of gone completely off the reservation over the past few days. He's almost... He was talking about cutting off relations with Israel, absolutely apoplectic. Then he was in Greece talking about tearing up Turkey's peace treaty with Greece, which kind of, he wasn't in Greece. The Greek prime minister was meeting with him, and he was there to kind of build ties and repair ties with Turkey. And then he comes out with this. So I don't know what his angle is exactly on that, but it will be interesting if he reaches out to the Pope as a mediator, because there is certainly something, a lot of tension building between Europe and Turkey right now. So it ties into a whole load of these different regional conflicts.
Well, it will be interesting to see how this affects the whole, the pressure on the progression of the peace process, and just to see how these outside powers, in particular European powers, will insert themselves into that process, the kind of dynamic that you'll see developing among Arab nations, the enemies of Israel, and what Israel does in response to this. At this point, there really do seem to be some conditions that are falling their direction, and yet we've also talked about just how many different pressures they have on them from several different directions that will force them to look more robustly to outside help, which is what we're looking at from the standpoint of Bible prophecy. Brent, you want to just kind of put this in the context of the prophecies that we're looking at?
Certainly, there's a number of them, but the one that we're referring to is that in Hosea chapter 5 and verse 13, it talks about how Israel has a wound. And we've talked about this wound for 2 decades now, being this peace process with the Palestinians. And the scriptures clearly indicate that Israel is actually going to go to a king of Assyria, which is modern-day Germany, who is Germany being the most powerful nation in the EU. So we're looking for the Europeans to insert themselves, even with Israeli, it looks like the Israeli favor to do so, mm-hmm. Coming in the future. And so that's why when Mr. Trump looks to do things that jeopardize the future of the peace process, and you have the European Union standing there with their hands up saying, we'll do it, we'll mediate, that's when we really start looking for Bible prophecy starting to be fulfilled here.
Yeah, in some ways it seems like the potential for the United States to come out of all of this essentially looking like a delegitimized broker of peace, and Israel, even if Israel says, you know, we appreciate what you did, but if we're going to be able to make any progress, and particularly if pressure increases, terrorist attacks or outside influence in Israel to push forward with some kind of a plan, that you could see them saying, well, let's go ahead and go to the next best option that we would have. And Europe standing there with its hand up in the air saying, you know, we're happy to help. So just for anyone who is interested in more information about this, we can certainly point you to the Jerusalem in Prophecy booklet, a huge resource that we have for anyone who's interested in the future of that city and how events today are going to play out in Bible prophecy. We definitely have a lot of detail that the scriptures give us about what's going to happen in Jerusalem, and that's an excellent resource to look at. Anything else that you might want to point people to, Brent?
Yeah, I would just go to thetrumpet.com right now and look at a number of articles we have. We have one from our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, entitled Jerusalem. Mr. Brad McDonald had a piece this week, Jerusalem and Donald Trump's Entirely Unremarkable Declaration. And then we have just another couple of historical pieces that really attack this subject from different angles. And you can be up to date and fully aware of the biblical prophecies by clicking on a few of those links.
And one more that will be going up any minute now from Mr. Stephen Flurry.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, gents. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We're going to go now to North Korea. Recent developments there have shown just how significant of a threat the regime of Kim Jong-un is to peace. And it looks as though the United States is well within range of North Korean nuclear strike. Diplomatic and economic efforts to contain this threat have failed. And recent reports underline the reason why that is the case. For this story, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, a really interesting story broke this week showing that the price of fuel inside North Korea has plummeted over the last month or so. And this is thanks to an influx of fuel coming into North Korea from Russia. This news broke on December 4th when journalists with Asia Press International reported that Russia is shipping, quote, massive amounts of fuel into the Rongyang province of North Korea. And this influx is so substantial that since early November, the price of diesel oil sold in the north has fallen by about 60%. And in the same time frame, the price of gasoline sold in North Korea has fallen by about 25%. So it's not possible to put the numbers of the actual quantity, to ascribe an actual number to that. But these precipitously falling prices show that the quantities are massive.
So we've talked less about Russia's role in propping up North Korea than about China. How much does the evidence show China being complicit in this?
Well, yes, it's really significant that this fuel is coming into North Korea's Rongyan province, because Rongyan does not border Russia. A different section of North Korea does share a border with Russia, all the way to the country's northeast corner there. But Rongyan borders China. So for China to be, or for Russia rather, to be covertly getting this fuel into the Rongyan province, it shows that the Russians would first have to ship it through a pretty sizable section of northeast China. So this does show that China is at a minimum complicit in this Russian fuel flooding into North Korea.
Okay, so Russia and China, both members of the UN Security Council. UN Security Council has passed resolutions that are specifically aimed at cutting off fuel to North Korea.
Yes.
This is in total violation of those. Is that not right?
Yes, it is. This, even just on September 11th, after North Korea had just conducted its sixth and largest nuclear test, both Russia and China voted to pass a United Nations Security Council resolution that banned exports of condensates and natural gas liquids to North Korea. And this same ban also restricted exports of refined petroleum products to the North. So both Moscow and Beijing signed on to these UN measures. And as a result, the price of fuel inside North Korea skyrocketed during late September and October. And then by early November, those prices were very high, indicating that the, you know, the economic pressure that the U.S. and the U.N. were striving to apply really was reaching a meaningful level. But that's apparently right around the time when these Russian fuel shipments began to arrive in North Korea via China. And the numbers show that the North Korean fuel is reducing that pressure on the North.
They're just playing games, these countries.
That's really what it looks like. They're appeasing the international community. They're signing on to official sanctions, but then they either bypass those sanctions illegally or they exploit legal loopholes within them. But basically, it looks like they're doing whatever they can to keep the regime of Kim Jong-un afloat kind of surreptitiously.
So put this in prophetic context for us.
Sure, yes. Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has recently said that it's actually Russia and China that the world should be more concerned about than North Korea. And that's in large part because it's those two nations that allow the North to behave as it does. And Mr. Fleury explained that this analysis of the situation is based on Bible prophecy. This was in a September 13th message, and he said, quote, "The Bible's prophecies show that in a sense, the North Korean crisis is a massive distraction from the real threat posed by China and Russia. These powerful Asian nations are the only reason North Korea is able to operate so freely, and Bible prophecy shows that they pose a threat many times greater than the one from North Korea." End quote. So the Bible prophecies that Mr. Fleury is referring to there can be found mainly in the books of Revelation and also in Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. And these books and chapters show that Russia will soon lead a vastly powerful military bloc. And these prophecies show that smaller Asian nations such as North Korea, they'll be assimilated into that Russian-led bloc and they'll lend their military power to it, but they will not be major players.
So you recorded a video on this recently, is that right?
Yes. Yes, we'll have a Trumpet Talk video going up possibly today or at some point over the weekend on this topic.
Okay. Well, you can check the trumpet.com for that and anything else that you would direct people to as far as resources to learn more information.
Yes, just for a broader picture of Russia's role in end time prophecy, I would recommend reading Mr. Fleury's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, and we'll have a link to that also in the show notes.
All right, fantastic. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Radio 101.3, a terrifying scene playing out in Southern California as wildfires engulf an area of miles and miles. It looks like the whole scene is actually poised to get even worse than it is right now. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, when I first saw the aerial image of the smoke of this online, I thought like a volcano had erupted someplace until I actually read the caption that, no, this is smoke rolling off of these wildfires. I had a friend send me some images from Highway 405 going into Los Angeles, where you could just see they've got all these hills surrounding that highway, just all on fire. Again, it almost looked like something from like this post-apocalyptic or volcanic eruption or something like that, where just everything as far as you can see is in flames. And these are that's only one of several fires spread out across Southern California that are currently burning. The biggest one's already consumed 140 square miles, which is like, you know, twice the size of Atlanta, Georgia, or something like that, just for comparison. So just a huge area. That fire, they had 27,000 people under mandatory evacuation, though I think it's getting up to close to a quarter of a million people that are across the state that they've recommended leave your homes before they burn down.
Mm-hmm. And what is it that now they're talking about wind conditions being unfavorable to being able to put this thing out?
Right, because I mean, initially, California's been in drought for a while, and then that's really conducive to these fires. But then once the fires got to a certain size, you got up to like 80 mile an hour winds that have basically just turned what would have otherwise been a more slow burning wildfire into like an inferno in a blast furnace. They actually came up, they call it code purple. I guess up till now, the highest code they'd ever had in California is like a code red danger for like wind danger in a fire zone. Like winds fueling the fire. This is a code red. And then now I think the category existed before, but this is their first ever. It's like code purple. It's even worse than code red. You've got 140 square miles on fire in like low category hurricane style winds. Mm.
So this doesn't bode well for efforts to contain the flames.
Yeah, they were getting to the point where they just about had it contained, and then the winds kicked up, and I think they lost all the gains the firefighters had pushing this back.
So looking at this just from the trumpet's perspective and from a biblical prophecy perspective, how are you viewing this?
Right. Well, obviously, almost most other news analysis you're going to get on this is going to talk about climate change, and it's actually snowing in Houston this week, and apparently that's global warming as well. They have this thing where you said it rains in Texas, and that's climate change, and it snows in Houston, and that's climate change, and there's drought in California, and that's climate change. But here at the trumpet, we really point out to a number of verses. I think the one that might describe this situation best is in Amos 4 and verse 7, where God's explaining some of the curses that he'd put on a nation that disobeyed his laws. And he said, "Also, I have withholden rain from you when there were yet 3 months in the harvest, and I caused it to rain upon one city and caused it to not rain upon another city. One piece of land was rained upon, and the piece that wasn't rained upon withered." Just showing that this is, and there's many, many other scriptures that we have outlined in our Why Natural Disasters booklet that we'll send anyone who writes for it. Just go through the Bible and explain, like the Amos 4 verse 7, where God says that he will cause natural disasters, but it's not just that everything's getting warmer or everything's getting colder or everything's getting drier or everything's getting wetter. It's you've got droughts and you've got fires and you've got earthquakes and you've got tornadoes and you've got hurricanes and you've got blizzards and all these different natural disasters that God says that he'll send as a curse upon the nation. And mm-hmm. actually, beyond just the natural, our Why Natural Disasters booklet, which we've advertised on this program many times before, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury's Key of David program coming up this week is called The Most Deadly Climate Change Deception. And that's on our website already. I mean, you can go there right now to the video section and watch that. If you don't want to watch it online, I think you'll have to wait till Friday before it starts hitting the television stations that are listed on the back page of our print edition of the Trumpet magazine. But that will also go through in about a 25-minute program, going through a lot of the more details on the biblical reasons of why things, climate, natural disasters like this happen.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. Andrew, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about Israeli strikes on Syria, signs of cooperation between South Korea and China, and a major religious leader warning of an end-time apocalypse. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Even as attention was riveted on America's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, Israel was launching attacks on Syria. To learn why, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so there have been substantial change. There has been a really substantial change in the fighting in Syria over the past week. And that's because for the first time in this war, Israel has directly attacked Iranian installations. Up to now, I think there have been about 100 Israeli airstrikes from mainly Lebanese territory and Israeli territory firing into Syria, western Syria, to attack weapons convoys as they come across from the Syrian regime to Hezbollah. Israel's policy is longstanding, has been to stop that. And so they've been doing that. But this time we did see a direct attack against an Iranian base about 15 kilometers south of Damascus. And if you're 15 kilometers south of Damascus, if you head basically west from there, you're going to hit the Israeli Golan Heights. And this base was about 50 kilometers from the Israeli border. And Israel has been really reinforcing its rhetoric over the past month, saying that this is a red line for them. They can't have Iranians anywhere close here to the Israeli border. They want them pushed back at least 60 kilometers away. And then it finally looked like last Friday night, Saturday morning, Israel attacked this base, destroying a number of buildings. Arab media said about 13 Iranian soldiers were actually killed in this. Iran hasn't said that, but others have. The Syrians came out and said that this was definitely an Iranian base, so it's not in dispute. And it marks the first time, as I said, that Israel has come into direct conflict with the nation of Iran.
Why the change specifically, do you think?
Well, I think this has gone back to what's being negotiated right now in eastern Syria. The United States, Russia, Iran, Turkey, they all have a desire, or maybe not the Iranians just yet, but the rest of them have a desire to work out some type of political settlement inside Syria. And there would be certain goals of this settlement would be for Israel is to make sure that there is no Iranians close to their border. The Russians and the United States have basically allowed the Iranians, in the terms of the agreement that looks like it's been signed or is being negotiated, to get kind of close to the Israeli border. And Israel has said all along the way, in messages to Putin, in messages to Mr. Trump, we're not going to do this. We're not going to allow it, sorry. And so they are attacking them. There was warning that this was going to happen. On November 20th, November 20th is when the Israeli Prime Minister met with Macron, or talked over the phone with Macron, and told him that he was going to attack Iran. This is a red line for us if they're in this zone. And then about a week before then, the BBC actually came out with a report stating that there was an Iranian base within this zone. So the Israelis no doubt knew about this base. The BBC kind of blew the cover off it, I believe, that made it public to everybody. And then Israel kind of had to enforce this red line that they had been talking about.
So what are the broader ramifications here? Any kickback from the international community about what's happened here? And what does this mean for Israel going forward?
I think if we didn't have if we didn't have what's been going on in Jerusalem this past week, this would have been talked about a whole lot more. But you didn't have much reaction from the Iranians at all. There's probably a number of Arab states in the Middle East that were quite happy with this. No doubt the Saudis would have been happy. The Jordanians would have been happy. They're worried right now that Iran is going to become entrenched on their border in southern Syria. And so there are probably a lot of nations that are looking at this saying, finally, a Western power is willing to set a red line and actually act on it against the Iranians. So looking at this in the broader picture, I believe that this is going to put Israel in more favorable terms with the anti-Iranian alliance led by the Saudis, possibly even some of the Europeans being involved in it. This is something that biblical prophecy indicates could happen, that you might have a temporary alliance between Israel and some of these other states as it counters Iran, and particularly concerning Iran's actions in Syria. and Lebanon. This is somewhere where the Saudis are going to have a willing ally in Israel to have some type of military action against Iran if the Saudis and even the Europeans decide that they want to put up some men themselves. They would have a secure flank here on eastern in eastern Israel and western Syria, just because the Israelis are willing to fight as well.
Israel does seem to have a knack for these types of strikes, getting in, getting out, doing what needs to be done here. They're degrading this Iranian military installation, but it does show that Iran is very active over there. We've been talking about this land bridge that they're trying to build to the Mediterranean. Here they are in western Syria, right next to Israel. They just keep pushing, don't they?
Yeah, Iran has had its stated goal to defeat Israel, to capture Jerusalem. While it sounds like this is some ethereal, far-off idea, they really do believe in it. And the fact that they have actual military bases, arms depots, ammunition depots, such as this one was, in western Syria proves that they are committed to their goal of taking Jerusalem. And this is something our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, has brought a lot of attention to in his book, King of the South, talking about how Iran's goal is Jerusalem and how Iran does want to mobilize the Islamic world behind them in achieving that goal.
You can find the King of the South booklet on thetrumpet.com under the literature tab, or you can look at the show notes for the program today to link to that booklet. We appreciate that, Brent. Going back now to Asia, next week, South Korea's president is going to visit China for talks on North Korea and other issues amid tentative signs of diplomatic movement. There's been a lot of tension over all that Pyongyang has been doing, its nuclear and missile threats. But now it looks like South Korea and China may be reconciling. For this, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, South Korean President Moon Jae-in, he announced this week that he will be visiting China next week for an official state visit. And this is President Moon's first trip to China since he's become the leader of South Korea there. And it's to begin on December 12th, and it'll last about 4 days. And he will be having several meetings during this trip with his Chinese counterpart, Mr. Xi Jinping. And the two are slated to talk about their bilateral relationship and investment and all kinds of issues of regional concerns, including, as you mentioned there, North Korea's rapidly progressing missile program and its nuclear weapons program. So this is a sign that South Korea and China are deepening their ties to a very significant degree.
And this, they were at least talking about trying to come to an understanding. All of the discussion over THAAD, that missile defense system that the United States wanted to install in South Korea, it seemed like that opened up diplomatic channels between these two.
Yes, that's right. A year or even 6 months ago, a state visit like this between Moon and Xi would have been totally unthinkable. And that's because of South Korea's decision to let the U.S. deploy the THAAD, or the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System, on Korean soil. And of course, President Moon allowed the U.S. to do that just because South Korea is terrified about the North Korean threat and wants America to be positioned to be able to intercept any North Korean missiles that could endanger South Koreans. But China was furious about that decision because they feared that the U.S. would use the THAAD system's advanced radar to possibly spy on China. So China actually ended up sanctioning South Korea over this move, and it cost the South Korean economy billions over the last year. And it really looked like the two sides could be hostile toward each other potentially indefinitely. But then in late October, seemingly out of the blue, China and South Korea announced that they had come to an understanding about THAAD, and they said that they were restoring all diplomatic ties. So this state visit next week by President Moon to China really couldn't have happened in the climate that was permeating everything there before, and it shows that China and South Korea really are determined to work closely together once again.
This is really interesting to see this playing out in light of the effort that, say, the Trump administration has been trying to has been making to try to get China on its side against North Korea. That doesn't seem to be working, as we were talking about in the first half of the program. South Korea, they're trying to use their relationship, their ties with South Korea, in order to contain North Korea, for basically for South Korea to be throwing its chips in with China in this way. It really kind of points to the future of what we can expect in this situation. The dynamic within Asia definitely seems to be shaping up according to the way that we would expect based on Bible prophecy.
That's exactly right. From the U.S. perspective, we would prefer for South Korea to have frostier ties with China. So the fact that the two are now warming things up pretty considerably shows that South Korea has other options. And it really could lead quickly to a situation where the Americans are no longer welcome on the Korean Peninsula. And as you mentioned, the trumpet keeps a really close eye on efforts by Asian countries to cooperate, because Bible prophecy makes clear that in the time of the end, there will be a powerful confederacy of Asian nations that join together, and they'll play a major role in World War III. And there are numerous Bible passages about this Eastern Bloc, and one of them in Ezekiel 38 shows that the Asian Bloc will include Magog, which is an ancient name for the area that includes modern-day China. And it'll also include what Ezekiel 38 calls Gomer, which is an ancient name for the primary ancestor of the modern Koreans. So the fact that these two nations are listed in Scripture makes us at the trumpet take a really keen interest in the suddenly warmer ties between China and South Korea.
And for more information, you'd send people where?
Well, we'll have a link in the show notes to an article called China and South Korea Restore Warm Relations. And that points to some of these scriptures there. And then we'll also have a link to our free booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, which will take anyone into a deeper dive through these relevant biblical passages.
All right. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. An interesting development in the German state of Bavaria. This week, the state's longtime premier announced that he would step down. You could really see this as an aftershock from the election earthquake in September in Germany, which revealed the vulnerability of the ruling party in Bavaria. Well, how will this man's replacement fare? Is he going to be able to stabilize the ship there, or might things take another unexpected turn? To answer these questions, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yes, this was really a big scalp, with Horst Seehofer stepping down as the premier of the state of Bavaria. Now, yeah, they're really being rocked by this political earthquake we're seeing in Germany. They're kind of in crisis because the Christian Social Union, Angela Merkel's sister party that only runs in the state of Bavaria, they only received 40% of the vote. Now, just about any other party in Germany would be ecstatic if they did that well. But for the CSU, this is a catastrophe. This, you know, they've ruled Bavaria almost without exception since, since 1966. They never usually have to go into coalitions with anybody. So for them to not get a majority is a big deal. And so because of that, they're in this kind of crisis. So Horst Seehofer has stepped down as the state premier, but he is still the head of the party, which is interesting. The party typically likes kind of one clear leader who's both the Bavarian premier and the leader of the party. And if that splits, then you're typically into some kind of interregnum. No, you're like waiting for the next strongman almost. So he stepped down. Markus Söder, who he does not like, Seehofer does not like at all, has replaced him as the premier of Bavaria. The media doesn't put a huge amount of confidence in him as a unifying figure and as someone who would turn this around. And there's a lot of, I'd say it's more solid than speculation, a lot of discussion that Seehofer is hanging on as leader of the Christian Social Union Party because he wants to save that spot for the man he wants to replace him.
Mm.
And that man is Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. He's long been a fan of zu Guttenberg, and for months people have been saying, well, this is the reason he's not stepped down. He's hoping zu Guttenberg will come along. He doesn't like Söder. He wants zu Guttenberg to be his replacement. So we'll see how this goes. Söder may well bring Bavaria and the CSU further to the right. People have been talking that way. But I think this this leaderless period that it looks like Bavaria is going into now, with this split command and Seehofer wanting zu Guttenberg to be the one that comes along and be the clear successor and the next strongman over there, is just going to be fascinating to watch. I mean, if you've listened to this program for any length of time, you'll be very familiar with that name, zu Guttenberg. We've been really focused on him. He really closely matches a lot of Bible prophecies about a coming strong leader, a coming king in Europe. And so we think there's a very good chance that zu Guttenberg could be that individual. So now you see just an opening up for him and somebody trying to save a spot for him. You saw him perform very well in the German elections, be very popular. So keep watching him in this next chapter of this German political crisis. For more on this, you can read our free booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. That will give you a great background on zu Guttenberg, on those Bible prophecies, and on why we say he matches those prophecies so well. So we'll put a link to that on the show notes, and you can go and read more there if you're interested.
All right. Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. A lot of people are looking around at world events and saying, well, are we living in the end times? One prominent religious leader who says yes is the head of the Russian Orthodox Church. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, as I said, November 20th, after a church service in Moscow, Patriarch Kirill, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, which has 100 million members worldwide, warned that mankind is approaching the apocalypse. Specifically, he said, one must be blind not to see the approach of the terrible moments of history about which the apostle and televangelist John the Theologian spoke of in Revelation. And then he went on to say that this apocalypse is being brought on by humanity's sinful behavior, and all who love Mother Russia need to rally behind the Russian Orthodox Church to make sure that this apocalypse doesn't happen.
Well, I guess in some ways you have to hand it to him for recognizing these are not normal times we're living in.
Yeah, I think I'd almost like to kind of pay him a qualified compliment on this. I don't compliment Patriarch Kirill very often as a former KGB agent. Huge supporter of Vladimir Putin's, but you do have to say that in Kirill's standpoint, as he is one of the only major church leaders in the world who's looking around and he's like, says, even a blind man can see that all the stuff that John wrote about is actually coming to pass. And he went on quite a bit talking more about just this godless, secularist society that promotes pornography and promotes transgenderism and promotes homosexual rights and the moral vacuum that's created in the Western world. And now people are turning to extremely violent religious groups like the Islamic State, trying to fill this moral void that the Christian world has left them with. And made some poignant points through there. Now and then later on, he again, this with Patriarch Kirill, he's also someone who's called Vladimir Putin a miracle from God for Russia, and some of his underlings in the Russian Orthodox Church have been even a little more blunt, how saying that like the United States in particular is like the Antichrist, and God has raised up Putin to be the restraining force talked about in 2 Thessalonians 2 that keeps the forces of the mystery of iniquity at bay. And so a lot of these, they're really looking at this is kind of like the Russian Orthodox Church and Russia's like role in the world is to oppose the Antichrist forces led by America and, in their view, to a lesser extent, Europe. And you get into more like the Russian Orthodox end view as a Bible prophecy, as it's kind of similar to the Roman Catholic Church, where you're thinking that, well, our church is the kingdom of God on earth, and so we need to keep people supporting us so that the apocalypse doesn't happen. It's this is a very bad thing. You don't want the apocalypse to happen and destroy the kingdom of God on earth.
Right.
Where when you go through Revelation, you don't even have to make it all that far into the book, before you realize that the end of the apocalypse is when Jesus Christ returns to earth on a white horse and establishes God's kingdom on planet Earth. So to that standpoint, I mean, these end time prophecies about the apocalypse and the Great Tribulation and World War III, they're very sobering, and it is the worst time ever in human history. But when you've understood Revelation, you can't help but get a little excited about it, because you know that once it's over, you've come to the kingdom of God on earth.
Yeah. Well, if somebody wanted more information about that, there's obviously the angle of how Russia and the Russian Orthodox Church and how that's playing out just geopolitically. But if people were interested in more information about just knowing, understanding the book of Revelation and the sequence of end time events, where would you send them to?
Right. Well, we do have the book Revelation Unveiled at Last that is does give you the time sequence of Revelation that anyone could call and request that will talk about some of these same things that Patriarch Kirill is saying that a blind man should be able to see, but it will go obviously in more detail towards the end of the book about how this isn't going to be a new Orthodox kingdom led by a czar or an emperor or any man, but this is going to be a new kingdom of God on earth led by Jesus Christ himself.
All right. Well, thanks for that. We actually have maybe another minute or so, a little bit of extra time. Richard, you had one more story you wanted to talk about, something we had on our website this week.
That's right. I just wanted to draw our listeners' attention to an article by Tyrell Schloeder on the website, American-German Relations Crumble. Sigmar Gabriel, who, the way things are right now, he's negotiating to be Angela Merkel's main coalition partner. He talked about these beginning to crumble. There was a poll in Germany that found that they thought that Donald Trump was a bigger threat than North Korea. And then you've got 56% saying that they were bad. Several polls talking about how dire these relationships are. Every time anything comes up, like North Korea, like Jerusalem that we spoke about at the start of the show, the German media especially is very negative, and it's all portrayed upon as being Donald Trump's fault. And these polls show that that's really cutting through. So there's a strong dislike of Mr. Trump building in Germany, building across all of Europe. A lot of that is to do with the way the media reports on him. But we've been talking for a long time about this split that's coming between America and Germany, this difference in thinking, and how this is going to have a major impact in the world going forwards. And we'll put a link for you to read more about that in the show notes for today's show.
All right. Thanks very much for that, Richard. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and the literature that we talked about on the program today. Let me know what you thought of the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been great to be here.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Henry David Thoreau. Society affects to estimate men by their talents, but really feels and knows them by their character. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.